Welcome to The Readout, a podcast by the Development Intelligence Lab, hosted by our CEO, Bridie Rice.
Well, it has been a busy few weeks in the aid and development space here in Australia. We've had Minister Wong's speech at the press club, Minister Conroy's speech in Brisbane earlier this month. Of course, we had the federal budget handed down, and we are waiting with bated breath for the release of the new development policy, a finance review, and frankly, a bit more information about this DFAT capability review as well. So I want to welcome our two guests, Jo Cho and James Gilling. Great to have you here on The Readout this morning.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Fantastic. We're going to dive straight in, and today we're going to tackle three things. We're going to tackle what happened in the budget and what does it mean. We're going to then dig into this DFAT capability announcement that came out earlier this month. And we're going to put our minds ahead to the new development policy, which we know will be released any moment. So let's dive in with the budget. Well, first Tuesday in May, it is always a big day here in Canberra, and we saw the release of a $4.76 billion aid budget. We saw a bit of a commitment to setting what some are saying is a ceiling on development or a floor on development spending over the next 10 years. And I would call the response from the development sector, frankly, a little bit muted. We had the Development Policy Centre, we had ACFID, IDCC, even us cautiously saying that this is a welcome stabilisation of the aid budget. And I'm keen to see what you make of it. So James, how would you characterise this budget? Is it safe and stable, new and exciting, or is it frankly a really big missed opportunity?
Maybe none of the above. I mean, clearly it's a reflection of where the government feels it sits financially. There's a lot of commitments in the budget outside of the development space, and they've clearly signalled that the development budget is not going to get a bigger chunk of what's available. Is that a good thing? Obviously, if you look at the sustainable development goals, which people tend not to do these days, but maybe they should, they'd realise we're in a pretty parlous state globally. I had a quick look before I came in for this chat, and 12% of the SDG indicators are on track, and we're halfway through. Over 30% have either not budged since 2015 or have gone back since 2015. So if that's not an environment where more resources were needed, then I don't know what it is. However, the government makes the calls. The call it's made is they're keeping it straight in nominal terms, and it's a bit of a decline in real terms. In this day and age, that's probably not good enough, but we have to deal with what we have to deal with. And as I said, there's many other priorities in the budget.
Joe, what about you? Australia is ranking 27 out of 30 when it comes to OECD donor countries. That's the ODA GNI ratio. Just how important is stabilising the budget? Would you be expecting more? And where's Australia sitting?
Yeah, I agree with James that it's not good enough. We obviously want to see Australia do a lot better than that on the global stage. I think Australia sees itself as a much more generous nation than that. So definitely over time, we want to see that ranking go way up. And I am really hopeful that this is just the beginning. It's a stabilisation phase. The government has indicated that they are aware that the ODA, the Australia's foreign aid, has taken a beating in past years. A lot of capability has been depleted. There's been a lot of budget cuts. So there's a lot of rebuilding to do. And they have been talking about that. And I think there are signs in this budget that they are seeing this as a rebuilding process. They've invested in improving DFAT development capability, which we're going to talk about, and that's a really important foundation to build a better, more effective, bigger development budget on. So I'm really hopeful that if you look at this optimistically, it's just the start and that there will be greater and more growth in the future. But building it on a stable foundation is really important.
Joe and James, you warned me that you guys were like chalk and cheese before you came in here. We've got Joe the optimist, James, I won't say what you actually described yourself as, but certainly objective and sceptical could be two words that come to mind. Joe, you're painting a hopeful picture here. James, I'm hearing some uncertainty. What would it take for you to believe that this government is serious about reinvesting in development in the coming decade?
I'm not saying the government aren't serious about the development program. I'm not saying they're not prepared to try and do more. I am saying that the plethora of commitments that exist across the public space is such that they have chosen fairly explicitly not to increase at the sort of pace that global experience would suggest is necessary. I mean, again, other donors are going much bigger. France, I think, has almost doubled. So it's not a question of opinions. We've got a government here that's saying we're not going to invest massively in the aid program at this stage. So it will boil down to, so how do you squeeze more out of the money that you are prepared to spend? So I think the whole conversation, I think it always has to have been this way, but I think the conversation needs to be, how do you spend money effectively rather than how much money are you going to spend? It would be nice if there were more money, but again, you know, you can't pick up a paper these days without seeing the commitments, and it's of absolutely no surprise that there isn't more money available.
Let's turn now to one of the big announceables that did come out of the early May budget, and that was around DFAT capability. Now, the need to build or rebuild DFAT capability when it comes to development has received increased attention over the past 6 months ago, 12 months ago. James and Joe, we've been having this conversation for years, and frankly, it was only a couple of years ago that we felt as though it could not be had publicly. That has shifted, and in the budget we saw what ACFID's actually describing as a headline measure, and that has been a $36.8 million commitment over 4 years explicitly to rebuild DFAT developmental capability. Now, both of you were at the situation room that we held at the lab with the DFAT Capability Task Force. We have discussed this in length. What are you making of this announcement, and where would you focus the spend of this money so that we got bang for buck on departmental capability?
Well, I think it's really positive that the commitment is so explicit. The minister has been very explicit that this is a priority. So acknowledging that there is an issue is the first step. And so I think there's going to be lots and lots of ideas floating around about how best to focus this investment, of course. I'm going to say something very maybe naive. People are going to call me a care bear, but I actually think that the first step in building a workforce that has development capability is building a workforce that actually cares about development, that it's an intrinsic value, that you are really focused on development outcomes, that you really care about that and you want to build your career dedicated to that. It's a cause, it's a vocation. So I think that's a starting point, because once you have that, you can build the skills and the tools and the capabilities that those people need to go and do that job. If you don't have that, then all the training and all the tools and all the manuals in the world are never going to achieve the same thing, because you need to be constantly striving for the best outcomes you can possibly get as a development actor. So that's my starting point. I've got a whole bunch of other things that I would build on top of that, but I think that's the foundation.
Joe, you've been on about this for quite some time. I'm going to play back to you what you said on the Intel on the 28th of July 2022. We said to you, what would it take for DFAT to be a world-class development agency? And you said it will take people, culture, partnerships and leaderships. Putting the right people in the right roles is a starting point. But you also said that these people and this expertise needs to be valued by the organisation. What needs to shift for that to happen right now?
Let me give you a really good example of a really central system in the organisation of DFAT that I think is critical to development outcomes, but also speaks to things like leadership and culture and right people in the right jobs. The posting system. If we look at the way that DFAT selects who goes out to which country to manage which program, to me it's not fit for purpose in terms of development outcomes, because it's the same system whether you're doing development or trade or consular or political. So you've got long-term development goals, a need to really understand local context, develop strong relationships, and have the programmatic understanding to then translate aid dollars into effective development outcomes working with those partners in that context. The people with the skills to do that and the desire to do that need to be the people going into those roles in those countries. We need a posting system that is actually going to deliver that for us. The people that end up managing those programs in our partner countries can make or break those programs. They have enormous influence, leverage, and impact on the ultimate outcomes. So for me, if we're serious about development capability, looking at something as deeply entrenched and systematized in DFAT as posting decisions would absolutely go to the guts of it.
So in the announcement, it said that the DFAT capability would be focused on implementation, evaluation, transparency, and accountability. And we're all on the line recently with DFAT where we pushed a little bit on this. And we said, what is this DFAT capability uplift going to look like? And we know that we will get more information upon the release of the development policy. So we're watching and waiting on this closely. Joe, your Care Bear piece, is that captured in what we know so far about where the focus on capability will be?
I think that all those elements matter, obviously. The Care Bear piece is really about the implementation. There is so much that needs to come together to make implementation effective. And so that's where the Care Bears need to be out there doing their thing. But I think the evaluation, the transparency, the accountability, they're all elements of the system that need to fit in behind and scaffold those people and enable the whole system to function in a way that it needs to. And I guess it's really the accountability piece that matters across the board. I mean, you might care and you might be out there doing your best, but you still need to be accountable for what you're doing and whether it's achieving outcomes. That goes for people in partner countries, it goes for people in Canberra, and it goes for the rest of the development sector as well that are trying to understand what's going on and call for better practices and more learning. So they're all intrinsic elements of a functional system, and I think that they all matter, but implementation is really where the rubber hits the road.
James, certainly not your first rodeo when it comes to thinking about DFAT capability. You've got a long and distinguished career and have worked really, really hard to build a cadre of people around you, both inside the department and now, of course, outside as well, of people who care and who think deeply and are looking to be the sort of workforce that Australian development might need for the future. What's your take on this announcement?
Look, in some ways, I think the 37 million is a bit of a red herring. So it's 37 million over 4 years. So $9 million a year for a department whose budget is what? Looks round table, gets no helpful looks.
$4.7 billion.
That's the aid. And so call it $6 billion all up. And we're sort of talking about the $9 million. So my view would be, it goes back to what I said earlier, that the challenge, whether it's $4.7 billion or $6 billion or wherever we want it to be, and I'd prefer it to be in the six, by the way, just for the record. The challenge is spending that money wisely. Joe is absolutely spot on. These are complicated things to do. We really need the best people to be able to do it. And frankly, you can't define what the best person is. There's such a wide range. I mean, just look in the last few years where suddenly the department has expanded into financial areas that it had no experience of before and is doing, in many ways, a great job in that space. But what do you need to do to a system to ensure that it can handle growing, complex environments, which are truly some of the world's most challenging issues? And scarcely a year goes by without it becoming more complicated. We now, of course, have high inflation. We now have climate change. So what do you do about that? And I think it does go to the question of a system, and a system needs to be accountable, and a system needs to be clear about what it's trying to achieve, and a system needs to have leadership. All of those aspects are not going to be changed very much by an extra 36, 37 million. I'd far rather hear a bit along the lines of what Andrew Mitchell tried to do in the UK, to set a framework that would drive those changes rather than become focused on, frankly, irrelevant sums of money.
What would you put in your framework if you're holding the pen, James?
I think you have to think about, there's an issue about sequence, and unless you've got accountability in that sequence, then you're sort of flying blind. So one of the things Mitchell talked about in the UK was public recognition, and he said he was going to put in the performance agreements of his senior bureaucrats a target for getting public support of the aid program up from where it is at the moment, which I understand is about 50%, up to 70%. There's a really clear statement. Whether it's the right thing to do, we could debate. But there's a really clear statement. His bureaucrats are going to be under no illusions about what his job is. So a really clear set of targets, a really clear set of accountabilities is critical to getting things moving.
And of course, when we're talking about development capability of Australia writ large, DFAT is only one piece of the puzzle. The department administers the ODA program, but of course it is delivered primarily through NGOs, managing contractors, research agencies, amazing local organisations and private sector entities as well. What would you expect to see beyond the department if we're serious about building the sort of development capability that Australia wants to offer in the decades ahead?
Well, the reality is it is a partnership. Whether you're like Joe and I representing managing contractors, whether it's NGOs, whether it's local community groups, this is scarcely ever about a single group. It's always a complex range of individuals who are involved. I think clarity around what individual roles are, humility about whose responsibility is what, capacity to listen to local organizations, understand where they're coming from, realistic timeframes. I mean, the danger is that you slip into just generalizations. The issue is about how you deal with complexity. And that requires the sort of leadership and open mind and constructiveness and feedback loops that you do in every system.
Interestingly, when we conducted the pulse check last year, and of course both of you were key contributors to that process, we went out to 50 Australian experts, 50 Pacific experts, and we said to them, what is the one thing that you would shift to unleash the potential of Australian development? And what we expected was an answer that looked a little bit more like perhaps a greater focus on education or perhaps a different level of capability on digital. But what came back to us as the one single barrier that would unlock the ability of Australia to be a great development partner to the region was actually DFAT capability. So it's good to see this work happening, and I think we'll all keep a close eye on it going forward. So now turning to the new development policy, we're of course waiting with bated breath for the release of it. And given what we've seen in the budget, I guess I'm wondering about what the level of ambition will be for the new development program. Joe, you've got a bit of an inside run. You were sitting on the independent panel, so I don't know how much you can share. But what are the bets and what are the thoughts that you've got as we wait now for the release of this policy?
Well, I have seen a few drafts of the policy, but I don't know what will be in the final either. But I think if you read Pat Conroy's most recent speech, you'll get a pretty good idea. He's pretty much laid out a lot of what's going to be in the development policy pretty explicitly. So I think part of the complexity is going to be that it is a huge and complex agenda with multiple streams of different issues and themes and considerations running all at once. So I think it's necessary because we are living in a complex world. There is a multifaceted agenda out there, but it is going to be a big ask for everyone to be thinking about all those different themes and also bring them all together in how we actually operate. It's going to be a policy that's very much about the how. And I think that's really important. I do think that his focus and the government's focus on genuine partnerships is going to be the ballast of the policy, and everything is going to feed into that. I think that's really critical. And again, it comes back to that capability piece of having the right people in the right places who can bring all those elements together in each context. And again, I think all these different elements of thinking about climate change, thinking about locally led development, thinking about gender and disability, thinking about First Nations approach, those are all important in and of themselves. There are going to be complexities in how they are shaped in each context that we're working in a locally appropriate way, and how they are sequenced and delivered. So it's back to the Care Bears out there. They have a big job to do. We need the right people out there doing this.
And recently we saw a pretty big speech given by the UK Minister for International Development. We saw a shift in direction, even a rebranding coming out of the UK. Do you think we're going to see anything like that here?
Well, look at the person who hasn't seen the draft. I don't think so. Actually, I don't think Mitchell's was. I mean, Mitchell's was a literal rebranding, but I think I would be hesitant to suggest that it was anything. It's not quite as profound, I think, as it's been painted.
Bit of a back to the future moment, do you think, James?
Well, it's explicitly back to the future. Half the speech is about, you know, Britain rediscovering its glory days. And there is new money, but it's 2.5 billion quid and it's designed to compensate for the fact that 3.7 billion quid is being spent in the UK on refugees. So going to the Australian case, we left the last subject talking about your 50 experts and the importance of DFAT capability. The key capability there that we need to talk about is the capacity to act as a partner. Governments are not always brilliant at that. I mean, partly because there's a power asymmetry. But it's one of the Care Bear qualities that Joe has been advocating, the ability to relate to, communicate with, respect different partners with different backgrounds and different capabilities. This is the opportunity for the government to compensate for the fact that they haven't felt able to come to the party financially. If you can't come to the party financially, and my argument is that they haven't been able to, you have to come to the party with a sophisticated appreciation of how you make $4.7 billion really have an impact. And as we know, aid is not a unique technical space. It rewards expertise. It rewards, you know, clarity. It rewards constructive feedback loops where what works gets extended, what doesn't work gets culled. We need to see how the new program, we need to see how the new policy will deal with these issues. Yeah, I accept, you know, we need to understand what the government means around First Nations foreign policy. We need to understand what commitments are and what ambitions are in areas like localization and gender. We need to understand that. But what we really need to understand is how that system is going to work to deliver better results. And they've got some issues to deal with there. They've got a system that took a bit of a hit in terms of its capacity to monitor effectiveness. As Steve Howes has pointed out, we've got a system that seems to be suggesting that many projects are not succeeding. Well, what happens in that system? Does it just stop there? So I'm looking forward to a policy that can go beyond the broad statement of commitments to being clear about how, like Minister Mitchell has been in the UK, saying this is what I expect from my staff, this is what I expect from my organisation, this is what I'm going to hold you accountable to.
Two of our analysts here at the lab went back and looked at the last 40 years of independent evaluations of Australia's aid and development program, and they picked up the most critical mistakes that this new policy must rectify. And top of the pile was strategic clarity. Now, Joe, you're painting a pretty complex picture of a policy that is looking to respond to a whole host of activities. My fear is that this policy will try and play stakeholder bingo, giving something for everyone in it. And in doing so, it won't actually achieve that strategic clarity at all. And James, with us on the 27th of April, can I just play back to you what you wrote on the intel? You said, there are, however, some certainties when it comes to undermining the effectiveness of Australia's development program. And you said, most notably, it would be a policy that had an ambiguity of purpose. Now, when I'm walking around Canberra and talking about just how important it is to have very, very clear objectives in a new development policy, I'm in struggle town. Can you help me out? How would you explain to a senior bureaucrat or a senior parliamentarian just how important it is that this new development policy has clear development objectives?
Any bureaucrat worth their salt would understand that clarity of purpose is important, whether you're talking the aid program, whether you're talking the New South Wales roads program. Clarity of purpose is what's is, so they're not going to struggle with the concept of clarity, nor are they going to struggle with the concept of ambiguity. I mean, governments are governments, right? They've got multiple stakeholders. Life is difficult. You have to be as much as you can, all things to all people, because that's how you get, that's how you win the game. Built hardwired into systems is a tendency not to be clear. My view would be that we've got some encouraging beginnings. Both Minister Conroy and Minister Wong have talked about the aid program as being a tool of statecraft. In fact, wasn't even a tool. It was sort of central, I believe, is what the term they use, central to our statecraft. So, you know, there's a lack of ambiguity there. The ambiguity comes around what the aid program is designed to deliver. My view is we've signed up to the Sustainable Development Goals. My view is that the circumstances of the people in not only our immediate neighbourhood, but in sub-Saharan Africa facing 5 years of droughts and huge food insecurity is such that the aid program needs to have a very clear focus on the reduction of poverty and the improvement of people's capacities to survive and thrive. I think that is 100% consistent with what both ministers have said about the aid program. They want it to be, they talk about the aid program contributing to economic resilience. So it's all consistent. The question really is how, and making sure that it's really explicit about how we're going to monitor these things. It's not, you know, red and green. None of the projects that Joe or I works on can be simply classified red or green. Does it work? Doesn't it work? We've got to be sophisticated, but we've got to make sure that we invest in having a view on what's working and what's not working. And we've got to understand what the key contributors of effective aid programs are. And that includes experience, that includes respect, that includes deep understanding of the countries of our region. All of these need to be built. 37 million isn't going to be the difference between a good aid program and a bad aid program. What we need is a really explicit statement about what this money is designed to achieve, how we are going to monitor it, and what we're going to do if we don't achieve it.
Joe, what would be on your wish list for the new development policy?
What I'm really hoping we will see is a clear articulation of what it means to be a donor. What is the role of the donor? I think in development, we're often trapped by this idea that we are out there doing these things. We are out there solving poverty. We are out there delivering everything for everyone. That is not our role. Our role is to support and facilitate and come behind those actors out there that are striving for development in their own countries. The local actors that are doing this every day because it's their country, it's their lives, it's their community. And as an external donor that comes along with some resources and some experience and some know-how, we can do our best to come behind them to understand the dynamics of the place we're working in and living in and come behind those people so that they can achieve development for their countries. I'd really love to see an articulation of Australia's role in the region as being that player and doing away with this notion that we are coming in to solve all the problems.
Joe, you just got yourself a new job, a training with us in the Diplomatic Academy.
Excellent.
In the future, where we teach the role of a donor is at best a broker of development, not necessarily the primary actor at all. Well, we have certainly covered a lot today. We started with budget, we headed towards DFAT capability, we've finished with a couple of potshot ideas about what we might see in the coming weeks of the development policy. Joe and James, have you got any final thoughts?
I want to go back to this idea of statecraft. There's a lot of talk of all the tools of statecraft, all the tools in the toolbox. I really would like that conversation to be about how all the tools Australia has goes towards development outcomes. I think we talk about whole of government, we talk about statecraft as being all about our national interest. And of course, good development outcomes is in our national interest. So how can all those tools actually help in the process of development that we're striving for? I think it's the missed potential of the integration of AusAid into DFAT. The political nous, the understanding of local context, all the thinking that goes into understanding the nuances of what's going on politically and economically, all the relationships that are being built by all the different agencies Australia has out there. If we could harness all of that towards development outcomes, that would be so powerful. And that's not what I'm seeing the conversation being about when it comes to tools of statecraft. I would love to see a pivot of that thinking and energy into the development outcomes we're trying to achieve. So that's just one. I think reading recommendation, the last few paragraphs of Pat Conroy's speech where he talks about the moral case for aid, I found that as a Care Bear very heartening. And I would love to see, as James talked about, a greater political focus in getting the Australian people and the community engaged and revved up about what it is we're trying to achieve in development and actually caring about it. I think that is a really important goal for this development policy as well.
James, any final thoughts or a reading recommendation?
Can I just take on that final section of the Conroy speech? No, I just think it's a really interesting way to end. And it felt a little bit to be leading with his chin for an aid budget which was about to be announced that was flagging, as many have pointed out, Australia dropping further down the table on the percentage of GNI that's going to aid. So I think Steve Howes hinted that it would fall below Greece in the next couple of years. And, you know, Minister Conroy's point was talking about the great Australian philosopher Peter Singer's view of our responsibilities. You know, would you walk past a drowning child if saving that child meant that you got your shoes dirty? Well, I mean, you know, there's an interesting case about what's the equivalent financial sum of a country getting its shoes dirty. I don't know, is it 4.7 billion or is it a bit more? And I think that's the question that it begs. So yeah, I thought that was quite an interesting way to finish that speech.
Certainly running a multi-generational workforce here at the lab, that paragraph caused a few discussions internally as well. For us, on the one hand, there was recognition that it now being okay to talk about the values and the morals and the obligation Australia has as a key player in our region was a good thing for development. But I've got to say, that paragraph causes a lot of consternation as well for people who are concerned about a return to colonialism, a return to some sort of moral obligation being the underpinnings of aid and development, instead of a focus on the sort of partnership, the sort of integration and the sort of country we want to be in our region going forward. So from my perspective, I thought that was a positive thing, but I would like that moral case for aid to really mature in the coming years into a genuine discussion about who Australia is in the region, who we are as a country of the Indo-Pacific, and how we're relating to the people around us beyond perhaps some obligation to just do a bit of good. Because I feel as though that's something that the aid and the development sector really worked hard to overcome over the coming last few decades. And frankly, we're better than just having a moral case for development and some of the colonial practices that come with that. On that note, we might wrap up. Joe, fantastic to have you yet again at the lab. James, same goes for you. We'll see you back here in a fortnight.
Thanks.
Wonderful. Thanks, Bridie.
You've been listening to The Readout with long-term friends of the lab, Joe Cho and James Gilling. Joe is Head of Program Quality and Gender at DT Global Asia Pacific. James is Regional Vice President East Asia and Pacific at APT Associates. Both are appearing on The Readout in a personal capacity. They'll be back in 2 weeks' time to discuss more development issues with the lab. In the meantime, for more information on the lab's work, visit www.devintelligencelab.com and follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter. The Readout is recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal people, and the team at the lab pays respects to elders past, present and emerging. Content production by Julie Bolton, production management by Jason Staines, and music by Vijami Mehta.